Osugi whirled and shouted, "Mumbe! Was that you? What's wrong?" There was no answer. Osugi ran to the top of the steps. She let out a little cry, then swallowed her breath as she squinted at the shadow standing beside the fallen body and the sword, dripping blood, slanting downward from the shadow's hand.
Who's there?
There was no reply.
Who are you?
Her voice was dry and strained, but the years had not diminished her blustering bravado. The man's shoulders shook slightly with laughter.
It's me, you old hag.
Who are you?
Don't you recognize me?
I've never heard your voice before. A robber, I suppose.
No robber would bother with an old woman as poor as you.
But you've been keeping an eye on me, haven't you?
I have.
On me?
Why ask twice? I wouldn't come all the way to Mikazuki to kill Mambe. I come to teach you a lesson.
Eh?
It sounded as though Osugi's windpipe had burst.
You've got the wrong person. Who are you anyway? My name is Osugi. I'm the dowager of the Hongiden family.
Oh, how good to hear you say that. It brings back all my hatred. Witch! Have you forgotten Jotaro?
Jotaro?
In 3 years, a newborn babe ceases to be a baby and becomes a 3-year-old. You're an old tree. I'm a sapling. Sorry to say, you can't treat me like a sniveling brat anymore.
Surely it can't be true. Are you really Jotaro?
You ought to have to pay for all the grief you've caused my teacher over the years. He avoided you only because you're old and he didn't want to harm you. You took advantage of that, traveling around everywhere, even to Edo, spreading malicious rumors about him and acting as though you had a legitimate reason to take revenge on him. You even went so far as to prevent his appointment to a good post.
Osugi was silent.
Your spite didn't end there, either. You bedeviled Otsu and tried to injure her. I thought at last you'd given up and retired to Miyamoto, but you're still at it, using that Mambe to carry out some scheme against Otsu.
Still, Osugi did not speak.
Don't you ever tire of hating? It'll be easy to slice you in two, but fortunately for you, I'm no longer the son of a wayward samurai. My father, Aoki Tanzaemon, has returned to Himeji and, since last spring, is serving the house of Ikeda. To avoid bringing dishonor on him, I shall refrain from killing you.
Jotaro took a couple of steps toward her. Not knowing whether to believe him or not, Osugi moved back and cast about for a way to escape. Thinking she saw one, she bolted toward the path the men had taken. Jotaro caught up with her in one leap and grabbed her by the neck. She opened her mouth wide and cried,
"What do you think you're doing?"
She turned around and drew her sword in the same motion, struck at him and missed. While dodging, Jotaro pushed her violently forward. Her head struck hard against the ground.
"So, you've learned a thing or two, have you?"
she moaned, her face half buried in the grass. She seemed unable to dislodge from her mind the idea that Jotaro was still a child. With a growl, he placed his foot on her spine, which seemed very fragile, and pitilessly wrenched her arm around her back. Dragging her in front of the shrine, he pinned her down with his foot, but couldn't decide what to do with her. There was Otsu to think about. Where was she? He had come to know of her presence in Shikama largely by accident, though it may have been because their karmas were intertwined. Along with his father's reinstatement, Jotaro had been given an appointment. It was while he was on one of his errands that he had caught a glimpse through a gap in the fence of a woman who looked like Otsu. Returning to the beach 2 days ago, he had verified his impression. While he was grateful to the gods for leading him to Otsu, his long-dormant hatred of Osugi for the way she had persecuted Otsu had been rekindled. If the old woman was not disposed of, it would be impossible for Otsu to live in peace. The temptation was there. But killing her would embroil his father in a dispute with a family of country samurai. They were troublesome people at the best of times. If offended by a daimyo's direct vassal, they were certain to cause trouble. Finally, he decided the best way was to punish Osugi quickly and then turn his attention to rescuing Otsu.
"I know the best place for you," he said. "Come along."
Osugi clung fiercely to the ground, despite his attempts to yank her along. Seizing her by the waist, he carried her under his arm around to the back of the shrine. The hillside had been shaved off when the shrine was built, and there was a small cave there, the entrance to which was just big enough for a person to crawl through. Otsu could see a single light in the distance. Otherwise, everything was pitch black. Mountains, fields, streams, Mikazuki Pass, which they had just crossed by a rocky path. The two men in front were leading her by a rope, as they would a criminal. When they neared the Sayo River, the man behind her said,
"Stop a minute. What do you suppose happened to the old woman? She said she'd be right along."
"Yeah, she should have caught up by now."
"We could stop here a few minutes, or go on to Sayo and wait at the tea house. They're probably all in bed, but we could wake them up."
"Let's go there and wait. We can have a cup or two of sake."
They searched along the river for a shallow place and had started to cross when they heard a voice hailing them from a distance. It came again a minute or two later from much nearer.
"The old woman?"
"No, it sounds like a man's voice.
It can't have anything to do with us."
The water was as chillingly cold as a sword blade, especially for Otsu. By the time they heard the sound of running feet, their pursuer was almost upon them. With great splashes, he beat them to the other bank and confronted them.
"Otsu?" called Jotaro.
Shivering from the spray of water that had fallen on them, the three men closed in around Otsu and stood where they were.
"Don't move!"
shouted Jotaro, arms outstretched.
"Who are you?"
"Never mind. Release Otsu!" "You're crazy. Don't you know you can get killed meddling in other people's business?"
"Osugi said you're to hand Otsu over to me."
"You're lying through your teeth."
All three men laughed.
"I'm not. Look at this."
He held out a piece of tissue paper with Osugi's handwriting on it. The message was short.
"Things went wrong. There's nothing you can do. Give Otsu to Jotaro, then come back for me."
The men, brows wrinkled, looked up at Jotaro and moved onto the bank.
"Can't you read?"
taunted Jotaro.
"Shut up. I suppose you're Jotaro?"
"That's right. My name is Aoki Jotaro."
Otsu had been staring fixedly at him, trembling slightly from fear and doubt. Now, scarcely knowing what she was doing, she screamed, gasped, and stumbled forward. The man closest to Jotaro shouted,
"Her gag's come loose! Tighten it!"
Then, menacingly to Jotaro,
"This is the old woman's handwriting, no doubt about it. But what happened to her? What does she mean, come back for me?"
"She's my hostage,"
Jotaro said loftily.
"You give me Otsu, I tell you where she is."
The three men looked at each other.
"Are you trying to be funny?"
asked one man.
"Do you know who we are? Any samurai in Himeji, if that's where you're from, would be familiar with the house of Honiden in Shimonosho."
"Yes or no? Answer. If you don't surrender Otsu, I'll leave the old woman where she is until she starves to death."
"You little bastard!"
One man grabbed Jotaro, and another unsheathed his sword and took a stance. The first growled,
"You keep talking nonsense like that, and I'll break your neck. Where's Osugi?"
"Will you give me Otsu?" "No."
"Then you won't find out. Hand over Otsu, and we can put an end to this without anybody getting hurt."
The man who had grabbed Jotaro's arm pulled him forward and tried to trip him. Using his adversary's strength, Jotaro threw him over his own shoulder. But the next second, he was sitting on his behind, clutching at his right thigh. The man had whipped out his sword and struck in a mowing motion. Fortunately, the wound was not deep. Jotaro jumped to his feet at the same time as his attacker. The other two men moved in on him.
Don't kill him! We have to take him alive if we're to get Osugi back!
Jotaro quickly lost his reluctance to become involved in bloodshed. In the ensuing melee, the three men managed at one point to throw him to the ground. He uttered a roar and used the same tactic that moments before had been used against him. Ripping out his short sword, he jabbed straight through the belly of the man about to fall on him. Jotaro's hand and arm, halfway up to the shoulder, came away as red as if he'd struck them into a barrel of plum vinegar, but his head was cleared of everything save the instinct for self-preservation. On his feet again, he shouted and struck downward at the man in front of him. The blade hit a shoulder bone, and glancing sideways, tore off a slice of meat the size of a fish fillet. Screaming, the man grabbed for his sword, but it was too late.
"Sons of bitches! Sons of bitches!"
Shouting with each stroke of his sword, Jotaro held off the other two, then managed to seriously wound one of them. They had taken their superiority for granted, but now they lost self-control and started swinging their arms with utter abandon. Beside herself, Otsu ran around in circles, wriggling her bound hands frantically.
"Somebody come! Save him!"
But her words were soon lost, drowned by the sound of the river and the voice of the wind. Suddenly she realized that instead of calling for help, she should be relying on her own strength. With a little cry of desperation, she sank to the ground and began rubbing the rope against the sharp edge of a rock. It was only loosely woven straw rope, picked up by the wayside, and she was soon able to free herself. She picked up some rocks and ran straight toward the action.
"Jotaro!"
she called, as she threw a rock at the face of one man.
"I'm here too! It's going to be all right!"
Another rock.
"Keep it up!"
Still another rock. But like the first two, it missed its target. She rushed back to get more.
"That bitch!"
In two leaps, one man disengaged himself from Jotaro and took after Otsu. He was about to bring the blunt edge of his sword down on her back when Jotaro reached him. Jotaro drove his sword so deep into the small of the man's back that the blade pointed straight out from the man's navel. The other man, wounded and dazed, started to slink away, then broke into an unsteady run. Jotaro planted his feet firmly on either side of the corpse, withdrew the sword, and screamed, "Stop!" As he started to give chase, Otsu pounced forcefully on him and screamed,
"Don't do it! You mustn't attack a badly wounded man when he's fleeing!"
The fervency of her plea astonished him. He could not imagine what psychological quirk would move her to sympathize with a man who had so recently been tormenting her. Otsu said,
"I want to hear what you've been doing all these years. I have things to tell you, too. And we should get out of here as fast as we can."
Jotaro agreed quickly, knowing that if word of the incident reached Shimonosho, the Honidens would round up the whole village to come after them.
"Can you run, Otsu?"
"Yes, don't worry about me."
And run they did, on and on through the darkness until their breath gave out. To both, it seemed like the old days when they had been a young girl and a mere boy making their way together. At Mikazuki, the only lights visible were at the inn. One shone in the main building, where only a little earlier a group of travelers, a metal merchant whose business took him to the local mines, a thread salesman from Tajima, an itinerant priest, had been sitting around talking and laughing. They had all drifted off to bed. Jotaro and Otsu sat talking by the other light, in a small detached room where the innkeeper's mother lived with her spinning wheel and the pots in which she boiled silkworms. The innkeeper suspected the couple he was taking in were eloping, but he had the room straightened up for them anyway. Otsu was saying,
"So you didn't see Musashi in Edo either?"
She gave him an account of the last few years. Saddened to hear that she had not seen Musashi since that day on the Kiso High Road, Jotaro found it difficult to speak. Yet he thought he was able to offer a ray of hope.
"It's not much to go on,"
he said. But I heard a rumor in Himeji that Musashi would be coming there soon.
To Himeji? Could it be true?
She asked, eager to latch on to even the flimsiest straw. It's only what people say, but the men in our fief are talking as though it's already decided. They say he'll pass through on his way to Kokura, where he's promised to meet a challenge from Sasaki Kojiro. That's one of Lord Hosokawa's retainers.
I heard something like that, too, but I couldn't find anybody who had heard from Musashi or even knew where he was.
Well, the word going around Himeji Castle is probably reliable. It seems the Hanazono Myoshinji in Kyoto, which has close connections with the House of Hosokawa, informed Lord Hosokawa of Musashi's whereabouts, and Nagaoka Sado, he's a senior retainer, delivered the letter of challenge to Musashi.
Is it supposed to happen soon?
I don't know. Nobody seems to know exactly. But if it's to be in Kokura, and if Musashi's in Kyoto, he'll pass through Himeji on the way.
He might go by boat.
Jotaro shook his head. I don't think so. The daimyo at Himeji and Okayama and other fiefs along the inland sea will ask him to stop over for a night or so. They want to see what kind of man he really is and sound him out about whether he's interested in a position. Lord Ikeda wrote to Takuan. Then he made inquiries at the Myoshinji and instructed the wholesalers in his area to report if they see anyone answering Musashi's description.
That's all the more reason to suppose he won't go by land. There's nothing he hates worse than a lot of fuss. If he knows about it, he'll do his best to avoid it.
Otsu seemed depressed, as if she'd suddenly lost all hope.
"What do you think, Jotaro?" she asked pleadingly. "If I went to the Myoshinji, do you think I'd be able to find out anything?"
"Well, maybe. But you have to remember, it's only gossip."
"But there must be something to it, don't you think?"
"Do you feel like going to Kyoto?"
"Oh, yes. I'd like to leave right away. Well, tomorrow."
"Don't be in such a hurry. That's why you're always missing Musashi. The minute you hear a rumor, you accept it as fact and go flying off. If you want to spot a nightingale, you have to look at a point in front of where its voice comes from. It seems to me you're always trailing along behind Musashi, rather than anticipating where he might be next."
"Well, maybe. But love's not logical."
Not having stopped to think of what she was saying, she was surprised to see his face go crimson at the mention of the word love. Recovering quickly, she said,
"Thank you for the advice. I'll think it over."
"Do that. But in the meantime, come back to Himeji with me."
"All right.
I want you to come to our house."
Otsu was silent.
"From the way my father talks, I guess he knew you fairly well until you left the Shippoji. I don't know what he has in mind, but he said he'd like to see you once more and talk with you." The candle was threatening to go out. Otsu turned and looked out under the tattered eaves at the sky.
"Rain,"
she said.
"Rain?
And we have to walk to Himeji tomorrow."
"What's an autumn shower? We'll wear rain hats."
"I'd like it better if it was fair." They closed the wooden rain shutters, and the room soon became very warm and humid. Jotaro was acutely conscious of Otsu's feminine fragrance. "Go to bed," he said. "I'll sleep over here." Placing a wooden pillow under the window, he lay down on his side, facing the wall.
"Aren't you asleep yet?" grumbled Jotaro. "You should go to bed."
He pulled the thin covers over his head, but tossed and turned a while longer before falling into a deep slumber.
The Mercy of Kannon. Otsu sat listening to the water dripping from a leak in the roof. Driven by the wind, the rain whipped in under the eaves and splashed against the shutters. But it was autumn, and there was no way of telling. Morning might dawn bright and clear. Then Osugi came into her thoughts. I wonder if she's out in the storm, all wet and cold. She's old. She might not last till morning. Even if she does, it could be days before she's found. She could die of starvation. Jotaro, she called softly. Wake up. She was afraid he'd done something cruel, since she'd heard him tell the old woman's henchmen he was punishing her, and had casually made a similar remark on the way to the inn. She's not really bad at heart, she thought. If I'm honest with her, one of these days she'll understand me. I must go to her. Thinking, if Jotaro gets angry, it can't be helped, she opened a shutter. Against the blackness of the sky, the rain showed whitely. After tucking up her skirts, she took from the wall a basket hat made out of bamboo bark and tied it on her head. Then she threw a bulky straw rain cape around her shoulders, put on a pair of straw sandals, and dashed through the sheet of rain pouring off the roof. On approaching the shrine where Mambe had taken her, she saw that the stone steps leading up to it had become a many-tiered waterfall. At the top, the wind was much stronger, howling through the cryptomerias like a pack of angry dogs. Where can she be? She thought, as she peered into the shrine. She called into the dark space underneath it, but no answer came. She went around to the back of the building and stood there for a few minutes. The wailing wind swept over her like breakers on a raging sea. Gradually, she became aware of another sound, almost indistinguishable from the storm. It stopped and started again.
Oh, hear me, somebody. Isn't somebody out there? Oh!
Granny! Shouted Otsu. Granny, where are you? Since she was literally crying into the wind, the sound did not carry far. But somehow the feeling communicated itself.
Oh, there's someone there. I know it. Save me. Here. Save me.
In the snatches of sound that reached her ears, Otsu heard the cry of desperation.
Where are you? She screamed hoarsely. Granny, where are you?
She ran all the way around the shrine, stopped a moment, then ran around it again. Almost by accident, she noticed what looked like a bear's cave, about 20 paces away, near the bottom of the steep path leading up to the inner shrine. As she drew closer, she knew for certain the old woman's voice was coming from within. Arriving at the entrance, she stopped and stared at the large rocks blocking it.
Who is it? Who's there? Are you a manifestation of Kannung? I worship her every day. Have pity on me. Save a poor old woman who's been trapped by a fiend.
Osugi's pleas took on a hysterical tone. Half crying, half begging, in the dark interval between life and death, she formed a vision of the compassionate Kannung and hurled toward it her fervent prayer for continued life.
How happy I am, she cried deliriously. Kannung, the all-merciful, has seen the goodness of my heart and taken pity on me. She's come to rescue me. Great compassion, great mercy. Hail to the Bodhisattva Kannung! Hail to the Bodhisattva Kannung! Hail to...
Her voice broke off abruptly. Perhaps she was thinking that that was sufficient, for it was only natural that in her extremity, Kannung would come in some form or other to her aid. She was the head of a fine family, a good mother, and believed herself to be an upright and flawless human being. And whatever she did was, of course, morally just. But then, sensing that whoever was outside the cave was not an apparition, but a real living person, she relaxed, and when she relaxed, she passed out. Not knowing what the sudden cessation of Osugi's cries meant, Otsu was beside herself. Somehow, the opening to the cave had to be cleared, and she doubled her efforts. The band holding her basket hat came loose, and the hat and her black tresses tossed wildly in the wind. Wondering how Jotaro had been able to put the rocks in place by himself, she pushed and pulled with the strength of her whole body, but nothing budged. Exhausted by the effort, she felt a pang of hatred for Jotaro, and the initial relief she had felt on locating Osugi turned to gnawing anxiety.
"Hold on, Granny, just a little longer. I'll get you out," she shouted.
Though she pressed her lips to a crack in the rocks, she failed to elicit a response. By and by, she made out a low, feeble chant.
"Or if, meeting man, eating devils, venomous dragons and demons, he thinks of Kannon's power, at once none will dare harm him. If, surrounded by vicious beasts, with sharp tusks and frightening claws, he thinks of Kannon's power."
Osugi was intoning the Sutra on Kannon. Only the voice of the Bodhisattva was perceptible to her. With her hands clasped together, she was at ease now, tears flowing down her cheeks, lips quivering as the sacred words poured from them. Struck by an odd feeling, Osugi left off her chanting and put her eye to a crack between the rocks.
"Who's there?" she shouted. "I ask you, who's there?"
The wind had ripped off Otsu's rain cape. Bewildered, exhausted, covered with mud, she bent down and cried,
"Are you all right, Granny? It's Otsu."
"Who did you say?"
came the suspicious question.
"I said, it's Otsu."
"I see."
There was a long, dead pause before the next incredulous question.
"What do you mean, you're Otsu?"
It was at this point that the first shockwave hit Osugi, rudely scattering her religious thoughts.
Why have you come here? Oh, I know. You're looking for that devil Jotaro.
No. I've come to rescue you, Granny. Please, forget the past. I remember how good you were to me when I was a little girl. Then you turned against me and tried to hurt me. I don't hold it against you. I admit I was very willful."
"Oh, so your eyes are open now and you can see the evil of your ways. Is that it? Are you saying you'd like to come back to the Hongidan family as Matahachi's wife?"
"Oh, no, not that,"
Otsu said quickly.
"Well, why are you here?"
"I felt so sorry for you, I couldn't stand it.
And now you want to put me under obligation to you. That's what you're trying to do, isn't it?"
Otsu was too shocked to say a word.
"Who asked you to come to my rescue? Not me. And I don't need your help now. If you think by doing me a favor you can stop me from hating you, you're mistaken. I don't care how badly off I am. I'd rather die than lose my pride."
"But Granny, how can you expect me to leave a person your age in a terrible place like this?"
"There you go, talking nice and sweet. Do you think I don't know what you and Jotaro are up to? You two plotted to put me in this cave to make fun of me, and when I get out, I'm going to get even. You can be sure of that."
"I'm sure the day will come very soon when you'll understand how I really feel. Anyway, you can't stay in there. You'll get sick."
"I'm tired of this nonsense."
Otsu stood up, and the obstacle that she had been unable to budge by force was dislodged as if by her tears. After the topmost rock rolled to the ground, she had surprisingly little difficulty rolling the one below it aside. But it hadn't been Otsu's tears alone that had opened the cave. Osugi had been pushing from inside. She burst forth, her face a fiery red. Still staggering from the exertion, Otsu uttered a cry of joy, but no sooner was Osugi in the open than she seized Otsu by the collar. From the fierceness of the attack, it looked as though her sole purpose in wanting to stay alive was to attack her benefactor.
"Oh, what are you doing? Ow! Shut up! Why? What did you expect?
Cried Osugi, forcing Otsu to the ground with the fury of a wild woman. Otsu was horrified beyond belief.
Now let's go,
snorted Osugi, as she started to drag the girl across the sodden ground. Clasping her hands together, Otsu said,
Please, please, punish me if you want, but you mustn't stay out in this rain.
What idiocy! Have you no shame? Do you think you can make me feel sorry for you?
I won't run away. I won't... Oh, that hurts!
Of course it hurts!
Let me...
In a sudden burst of strength, Otsu wrenched herself free and sprang to her feet.
Oh, no you don't!
Instantly renewing the attack, Osugi clutched a fistful of Otsu's hair. Otsu's white face turned skyward. Rain poured down it. She closed her eyes.
You tramp! How I've suffered all these years because of you!
Each time Otsu opened her mouth to speak or made an effort to wriggle free, the old woman gave a vicious tug at her hair. Without letting go of it, she threw Otsu to the ground, trampled on her, and kicked her. Then a startled look flashed across Osugi's face, and she let go of the hair.
Oh! What have I done?
She gasped in consternation.
Otsu!
She called anxiously as she looked at the limp form lying at her feet.
Otsu!
Bending down, she stared intently at the rain-soaked face, as cold to the touch as a dead fish. As far as she could tell, the girl wasn't breathing.
She's dead!
Osugi was aghast. Though unwilling to forgive Otsu, she had not intended to kill her. She straightened up, moaning and backing away. Gradually, she quieted down, and it was not long before she was saying,
Well, I suppose there's nothing to be done but go for help.
She started to walk away, hesitated, turned, and came back. Taking Otsu's cold body in her arms, she carried it into the cave. Though the entrance was small, the inside was roomy. Near one wall was a place where, in the distant past, religious pilgrims seeking the way had sat for long hours in meditation. When the rain let up, she went to the entrance and was about to crawl out when the clouds opened again. From the stream sluicing over the mouth, water splashed nearly to the innermost part of the cave.
It won't be long until morning, she thought.
Nonchalantly, she squatted and waited for the storm to die down again. Being in total darkness with Otsu's body slowly began to work on her mind. She had the feeling that the chilly, ashen face was staring accusingly at her. At first, she reassured herself by saying,
Everything that happens is destined to happen. Take your place in paradise as a newborn Buddha. Don't hold a grudge against me.
But before long, fear and the sense of her awful responsibility prompted her to seek refuge in piety. Closing her eyes, she began to chant a sutra. Several hours passed. When at last her lips were silent and she opened her eyes, she could hear birds chirping. The air was still. The rain had stopped. Through the mouth of the cave, a golden sun glared at her, shedding fresh white rays on the rough ground inside.
What's that, I wonder?
She said aloud as she got to her feet and her eyes fell on an inscription carved by some unknown hand on the wall of the cave. She stood before it and read,
In the year 1544, I sent my 16-year-old son, whose name was Mori Kinsaku, to fight at the Battle of Tenjinzan Castle on the side of Lord Uragami. I have never seen him since. Because of my grief, I wander to various places sacred to the Buddha. Now I am placing in this cave an image of the Bodhisattva Kannon.
I pray that this, and a mother's tears, will protect Kinsaku in his future life. If in later times anyone should pass here, I beg that he invoke the name of the Buddha. This is the 21st year since Kinsaku's death. Donor, the mother of Kinsaku, Aita Village.
The eroded characters were difficult to read in places. It had been nearly 70 years since the villages nearby, Sanumo, Aita, Katsuta, had been attacked by the Amako family and Lord Uragami had been driven from his castle. One childhood memory that would never be erased from Osugi's memory was the burning of this fortress. She could still see the black smoke billowing up in the sky, the corpses of men and horses littering the fields and byways for days afterward. The fighting had reached almost to the houses of the farmers. Thinking of the boy's mother, of her sorrow, her wanderings, her prayers and offerings, Osugi felt a stab of pain.
"It must have been terrible for her," she said.
She knelt and joined her hands together.
"Hail to the Buddha Amida! Hail to the Buddha Amida!"
She was sobbing, and tears fell on her hands, but not until she had cried herself out did her mind again become conscious of Otsu's face, cold and insensitive to the morning light by the side of her knee.
"Forgive me, Otsu. It was wicked of me. Terrible. Please forgive me, please."
Her face twisted with remorse. She lifted Otsu's body in a gentle embrace.
"Frightening. Frightening. Blinded by motherly love. Out of devotion to my own child, I became a devil to another woman's. You had a mother, too. If she had known me, she would have seen me as a vile demon. I was sure I was right, but to others, I'm a vicious monster."
The words seemed to fill the cave and bound back to her own ears. There was no one there, no eyes to watch, no ears to hear. The darkness of night had become the light of the Buddha's wisdom.
"How good you were, Otsu, to be tormented so many long years by this horrible old fool, yet never returning my hatred, to come in spite of everything to try to save me. I see it all now. I misunderstood. All the goodness in your heart I saw as evil. Your kindness I rewarded with hatred. My mind was warped, distorted. Oh, forgive me, Otsu."
She pressed her damp face against Otsu's.
"If only my son were as sweet and good as you. Open your eyes again. See me begging for forgiveness. Open your mouth. Revile me. I deserve it. Otsu, forgive me."
While she stared at the face and shed bitter tears, there passed before her eyes a vision of herself as she must have appeared in all those ugly past encounters with Otsu. The realization of how thoroughly wicked she had been gripped at her heart. Over and over she murmured,
"Forgive me! Forgive me!"
She even wondered if it wouldn't be right to sit there until she joined the girl in death.
"No!"
she exclaimed decisively.
"No more weeping and moaning. Maybe she's not dead. If I try, maybe I can nurse her back to life. She's still young. Her life is still ahead of her."
Gently, she laid Otsu back on the ground and crawled out of the cave into the blinding sunlight. She shut her eyes and cupped her hands to her mouth.
"Where is everybody? You people from the village, come here! Help!" Opening her eyes, she ran forward a few steps, still shouting. There was some movement in the Cryptomeria Grove, then a shout.
She's here! She's all right after all!
About 10 members of the Hongyiden clan came out of the grove. After hearing the story told by the blood-smeared survivor of the fight with Jotaro the night before, they had organized a search party and set out immediately, despite the blinding rain. Still wearing their rain capes, they had a bedraggled look about them.
Ah, you're safe,
exulted the first man to reach Osugi. They gathered around her, their faces reflecting their immense relief.
Don't worry about me, Osugi commanded. Quick, go and see if you can do something for that girl in the cave. She's been unconscious for hours. If we don't give her some medicine right away...
Her voice was thick. Almost in a trance, she pointed toward the cave. Perhaps not since Uncle Gon's death had the tears she'd shed been those of grief. The Tides of Life. Autumn passed, and winter. On a day early in the fourth month of 1612, passengers were arranging themselves on the deck of the regular ship from Sakai in Izumi Province to Shimonoseki in Nagato. Informed the ship was ready to leave, Musashi got up from a bench in Kobayashi Tarozaemon's shop and bowed to the people who had come to see him off.
"Keep your spirits up!"
they urged as they joined him for the short walk to the pier. Honwami Koetsu's face was among those present. His good friend Haiya Shoyu had been unable to come because of illness, but he was represented by his son, Shoeki. With Shoeki was his wife, a woman whose dazzling beauty turned heads wherever she went.
"That's Yoshino, isn't it?"
a man whispered, tugging at his companion's sleeve.
"From Yanagimachi? Yoshino Daiyu of the Ogia."
Shoeki had introduced her to Musashi without mentioning her former name. Her face was unfamiliar to Musashi, of course, for this was the second Yoshino Daiyu. Nobody knew what had happened to the first one, where she was now, whether she was married or single. People had long since stopped talking about her great beauty. Flowers bloomed, and flowers fell. In the floating world of the licensed quarter, time passed rapidly. Yoshino Daiyu. The name would have evoked memories of snowy nights, of a fire made of peony wood, of a broken lute.
"It's been 8 years now since we first met," remarked Koetsu.
"Yes, 8 years," echoed Musashi,
wondering where the years could have gone. He had the feeling his boarding the ship today marked the close of one phase of his life. Matahachi was among the well-wishers, as were several samurai from the Hosokawa residence in Kyoto. Other samurai conveyed best wishes from Lord Karasumaru Mitsuhiro, and there was a group of between 20 and 30 swordsmen who, despite Musashi's protest, had been led by their acquaintance with him in Kyoto to regard themselves as his followers. He was going to Kokura in the province of Buzen, where he would face Sasaki Kojiro in a test of skill and maturity. Due to the efforts of Nagaoka Sado, the fateful confrontation, so long in the making, was finally to take place. Negotiations had been long and difficult, necessitating the dispatch of many couriers and letters. Even after Sado had ascertained the previous autumn that Musashi was at Honwami Koetsu's house, completion of the arrangements had required another half year. Though he knew it was coming, Musashi had not, in his wildest dreams, been able to imagine what it would be like to set forth as the champion of a huge number of followers and admirers. The size of the crowd was an embarrassment. It also made it impossible for him to talk as he would have liked to with certain people. What struck him most forcefully about this great send-off was its absurdity. He had no desire to be anybody's idol. Still, they were here to express their goodwill. There was no way to stop them. Some, he felt, understood him. For their good wishes, he was grateful. Their admiration infused him with a sense of reverence. At the same time, he was being swept up on a wave of that frivolous sentiment called popularity. His reaction was almost one of fear, that the adulation might go to his head. He was, after all, only an ordinary man. Another thing that upset him was the long prelude. If it could be said that both he and Kojiro saw where their relationship was leading them, it could also be said that the world had pitted them one against the other and decreed that they must decide once and for all who was the better man. It had started with people saying, "I hear they're going to have it out." Later, it was, "Yes, they're definitely going to face each other." Still later, "When is the bout?" Finally, the very day and hour were being brooded about before the principals themselves had formally decided them. Musashi resented being a public hero. In view of his exploits, it was inevitable that he would be made one, but he did not seek this. What he really wanted was more time to himself for meditation. He needed to develop harmony, to make sure his ideas did not outpace his ability to act. Through his most recent experience with Gudo, he had advanced a step on the path toward enlightenment. And he had come to sense more keenly the difficulty of following the way, the long way through life. And yet, he thought, where would he be if it were not for the goodness of the people who supported him? Would he be alive? Would he have the clothes on his back? He was dressed in a black short-sleeved kimono sewn for him by Koetsu's mother. His new sandals, the new basket hat in his hand, all the belongings he carried now had been given to him by someone who valued him. The rice he ate, grown by other people. He lived on the bounties of labor not his own. How could he repay people for all they had done for him? When his thoughts turned in this direction, his resentment at the demands made on him by his legion of supporters lessened. Nevertheless, the fear of letting them down lingered. It was time to set sail. There were prayers for a safe voyage, final words of farewell, invisible time already flowing between the men and women on the pier and their departing hero. The moorings were cast off, the ship drifted toward the open sea, and the great sail spread like wings against the azure sky. A man ran out to the end of the pier, stopped and stamped his foot in disgust. "Too late!" he growled. "I shouldn't have taken a nap!" Koetsu approached him and asked, "Aren't you Muso Gonnosuke?" "Yes," he replied, tucking his staff under his arm. "I met you once at the Kongoji in Kawachi." "Yes, of course. You're Honami Koetsu." "I'm glad to see you're well. From what I heard, I wasn't sure you were still alive."
"Heard from who?"
"Musashi."
"Musashi?"
"Yes. He was staying with me until yesterday. He had several letters from Kokura. In one, Nagaoka Sado said you'd been taken prisoner on Mount Kudo. He thought you might have been injured or killed."
"It was all a mistake."
"We've learned, too, that Iori is living in Sado's house."
"Then he's safe!"
he exclaimed, relief flooding his face.
"Yes.
Let's sit down somewhere and talk." He steered the burly staff expert to a nearby shop. Over tea, Gonnosuke told his story. Luckily for him, after one look, Sanada Yukimura had come to the conclusion he was not a spy. Gonnosuke was released, and the two men became friendly. Yukimura not only apologized for his subordinate's error, but sent a group of men to search for Iori. When they failed to find the boy's body, Gonnosuke assumed he was still alive. He had spent his time since then searching the neighboring provinces. When he heard that Musashi was in Kyoto, and a bout between him and Kojiro was imminent, he had intensified his efforts.
Then, returning to Mount Kudo yesterday, he had learned from Yukimura that Musashi was to sail for Kokura today. He had dreaded facing Musashi without Iori at his side, or any news of him. But, not knowing whether he would ever again see his teacher alive, he came anyway. He apologized to Koetsu as though the latter were a victim of his negligence.
"Don't let it worry you," said Koetsu. "There'll be another ship in a few days."
"I really wanted to travel with Musashi."
He paused, then went on earnestly.
"I think this trip may be the decisive point in Musashi's life. He disciplines himself constantly. He isn't likely to lose to Kojiro. Still, in a fight like that, you never know. There's a superhuman element involved. All warriors have to face it. Winning or losing is partly a matter of luck."
"I don't think you need to worry." Musashi's composure was perfect. He seemed completely confident.
"I'm sure he did, but Kojiro has a high reputation too. And they say since he went into Lord Tadatoshi's service, he's been practicing and keeping himself fit."
"It'll be a test of strength between a man who's a genius, but really somewhat conceited, and an ordinary man who's polished his talents to the utmost, won't it?"
"I wouldn't call Musashi ordinary."
"But he is. That's what's extraordinary about him. He's not content with relying on whatever natural gifts he may have. Knowing he's ordinary, he's always trying to improve himself. No one appreciates the agonizing effort he's had to make. Now that his years of training have yielded such spectacular results, everybody's talking about his God-given talent. That's how men who don't try very hard comfort themselves."
"Thank you for saying that," said Gonnosuke.
He felt Koetsu might have been referring to him, as well as to Musashi. Looking at the older man's broad, placid profile, he thought, "It's the same with him, too." Koetsu looked like what he was, a man of leisure who had deliberately set himself apart from the rest of the world. At the moment, his eyes lacked that gleam that emanated from them when he concentrated on artistic creation. Now they were like a smooth sea, calm and unruffled, under a clear, bright sky. A young man stuck his head in the door and said to Koetsu,
"Shall we go back now?"
"Ah, Matahachi,"
Koetsu replied amiably.
Turning to Gonnosuke, he said, "I suppose I'll have to leave you. My companions seem to be waiting." "Are you going back by way of Osaka?"
"Yes. If we get there in time, I'd like to take the evening boat to Kyoto."
"Well then, I'll walk that far with you."
Rather than wait here for the next boat, Gonnosuke had decided to travel overland. The three of them walked side by side, their talk rarely straying from Musashi, his present status and past exploits. At one point, Matahachi expressed concern, saying,
"I hope Musashi wins, but Kojiro's sharp. His technique is terrific, you know."
But his voice lacked enthusiasm. The memory of his own encounter with Kojiro was too vivid. By twilight, they were on the crowded streets of Osaka. Simultaneously, Koetsu and Gonnosuke noticed Matahachi was no longer with them.
"Where could he have gone?" asked Koetsu.
Retracing their steps, they found him standing by the end of the bridge. He was looking spellbound out over the riverbank, where wives from nearby dwellings, a row of broken-down shacks covered by a single roof, were washing cooking utensils, unhulled rice and vegetables.
"That's an odd expression on his face," said Gonnosuke.
He and Koetsu stood a little apart and watched.
"It is her!" cried Matahachi. "Akemi!"
In the first flash of recognition, he was struck by the capriciousness of fate. But immediately, it began to seem otherwise. Destiny was not playing tricks, merely confronting him with his past. She had been his common-law wife. Their karmas, too, were entwined.
So long as they inhabited the same earth, they were fated to come together again, sooner or later. He'd had trouble recognizing her. The charm and coquettishness of even 2 years ago had vanished. Her face was incredibly thin. Her hair was unwashed and tied in a bun. She wore a tubular-sleeved cotton kimono reaching slightly below her knees, the utilitarian garment of all lower-class urban housewives. It was a far cry from the colorful silks she had donned as a prostitute. She was crouching down in the position expected of peddlers and had in her arms a heavy-looking basket from which she was selling clams, abalone, and kelp. The things still left unsold suggested business was not very good. Tied to her back with a soiled strip of cloth was a baby about a year old. More than anything else, it was the child that made Matahachi's heart beat faster. Pressing his palms against his cheeks, he counted up the months. If the baby was in its second year, it had been conceived while they were in Edo, and Akemi had been pregnant when they were publicly whipped. The light of the evening sun, reflected from the river, danced on Matahachi's face, making it seem bathed in tears. He was deaf to the bustle of traffic moving along the street. Akemi was walking slowly down by the river. He started after her, waving his arms and shouting. Koetsu and Gonnosuke followed.
Matahachi, where are you going?
He had forgotten all about the two men. He stopped and waited for them to catch up.
I'm sorry, he mumbled. To tell the truth.
Truth? How could he explain to them what he was going to do when he couldn't explain it to himself? Sorting out his emotions was beyond him at the moment, but finally he blurted out,
I've decided not to be a priest, to return to ordinary life. I haven't been ordained yet.
Returning to ordinary life? Exclaimed Koetsu. So suddenly? You look strange.
I can't explain it now. Even if I did, it'll probably sound crazy. I just saw the woman I used to live with, and she's carrying a baby on her back. I think it must be mine.
Are you sure?
Yes, well...
Now calm down and think. Is it really your child?
Yes. I'm a father. I'm sorry. I didn't know. I'm ashamed. I can't let her go through life like that, selling things out of a basket like a common tramp. I've got to go to work and help my child.
Koetsu and Gonnosuke looked at each other in dismay. Though not quite sure whether Matahachi was still in his right mind, Koetsu said,
I suppose you know what you're doing.
Matahachi took off the priest's robe covering his ordinary kimono and handed it to Koetsu, together with his prayer beads.
I'm sorry to trouble you, but will you give these to Gudo at the Myoshinji? I'd appreciate it if you'd tell him I'm going to stay here in Osaka, get a job, and be a good father.
Are you sure you want to do this? Give up the priesthood, just like that?
Yes. Anyway, the master told me I could go back to ordinary life any time I wanted to. He said you don't have to be in a temple to practice religious discipline. It's more difficult, but he said it's more praiseworthy to be able to control yourself and keep your faith in the midst of lies and filth and conflict. All the ugly things in the outside world than in the clean, pure surroundings of a temple.
I'm sure he's right.
I've been with him more than a year now, but he hasn't given me a priestly name. Always just calls me Matahachi. Maybe something will come up in the future I don't understand. Then I'll go to him immediately. Tell him that for me, won't you?
And with that, Matahachi was gone. The Evening Boat. A single red cloud, looking like a great steamer, hung low over the horizon. Near the bottom of the glassy, waveless sea was an octopus. Around noon, a small boat had tied up in the estuary of the Shikama River, discreetly out of sight. Now, as twilight deepened, a thin column of smoke rose from a clay brazier on the deck. An old woman was breaking sticks and feeding the fire.
Are you cold? She asked.
No,
answered the girl, lying in the bottom of the boat behind